It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, it's a fun time to be a Milwaukee Brewers fan as the crew is off to their best start in franchise history. A sports writer tells us how they're getting it done. First, Wisconsin Supreme Court Justice Shirley Abrahamson announced yesterday that she won't seek re-election next year. In a statement released by her office yesterday, she said, quote, I intend my last day on the court will be July 31st, 2019. Until then, and as I have done for my entire judicial career, I will continue to express my point of view. I will do so on the bench, and if principles and values integral to this great state of Wisconsin and its courts continue to be challenged, I will also express my views off the bench if necessary and as appropriate, end quote. Abrahamson's career has been one of firsts in longevity. She was first appointed to the court in 1976 by Governor Pat Lucey, making her the first woman on the court. She's now the longest-serving Wisconsin Supreme Court justice and served as the state's chief justice for almost 20 years. Our next guest is here to talk about her legacy on the bench and how her exit could shape the Wisconsin Supreme Court moving forward. Aaron Weinschenk is an associate professor of political science at UW-Green Bay. Aaron, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, take us back to the appointment of Shirley Abrahamson in 1976, a first woman on the Wisconsin Supreme Court. Give us some context there.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's pretty important to see women who have been traditionally underrepresented in high level political offices be appointed to the state Supreme Court and then serve for as long as she has. So I think it's a really important appointment initially.
And she is the longest serving justice in Wisconsin Supreme Court history. She broke that record a few years back. It is adding to it now. That means she had to be reelected a few times along the way after that initial appointment. Can you talk about her longevity on the court?
Yes, sir. It will be over 40 years when she finally steps down. But I saw in her press release, she said she's been reelected numerous times, in most cases with pretty large majorities, in some cases, like twice as many votes as her opponent had. So pretty amazing to serve for that long and then to win by pretty large margins each time.
And under laws that were changed, rules that were changed recently, Wisconsin's Supreme Court Chief Justice was based on seniority, so she held that spot for a long time. Can you talk about Shirley Abrahamson as the Chief Justice of the state's Supreme Court?
Yeah, I think, I was just reading, I don't know too much about her, rulings, but I was reading about kind of what other people thought about her, and what I discovered was that even people who maybe didn't like the outcomes of her decisions or didn't like, her ideology, thought that she was a really good justice, thought that she provided reasons, that she really championed the perspectives that she had, so from what I can tell, respect, even from people who wouldn't necessarily say they're on her ideological side.
And let's talk about that ideological side concept. Our Supreme Court justices in Wisconsin are elected to these 10-year terms. They're nonpartisan elections, which means there's not a Democrat or a Republican label that goes with them. But people perceive the court as partisan. Do you think that has gotten more so over the years, over the decades?
Yeah, definitely. I think that, it's hard for people to think of judges or justices as being partisan or being ideological, but the fact is that they are. There's decades of research showing that judges and justices, even at the highest levels like the U.S. Supreme Court, have ideologies and that their ideological positions influence their decisions. I definitely think that people have come to see courts as partisan or ideological battlegrounds more so now than in the past. I think justices have always had ideologies, but they're really on full display with the nature of elections and different partisan and ideological groups getting involved and spending money, and sometimes people even saying that they support the president or don't like the president very much. So it's pretty clear these days that even though they're nonpartisan, they are actually partisan affairs.
It's interesting when you look at the U.S. Supreme Court, which is nominated by the president, approved by the Senate, so there's no public election. Here in Wisconsin, we have public elections to the Supreme Court, and result seems to be the same, this sort of partisan split and this competition for one side or the other to control the majority.
Yep. I mean, I think people, they get the cues about where candidates stand. On the last election, it was pretty easy for people to pick up on you know, who was the liberal and who was the conservative, whether it was through speeches or campaign ads or spending or interviews. So, you know, even though we do have these nonpartisan elections, you know, people get the signals that, you know, people have different ideological positions.
Talking to Aaron Weinschenk, Associate Professor of Political Science at UW-Green Bay, looking at the announcement from Wisconsin, long-serving Wisconsin Supreme Court Justice Shirley Abramson, that she will not run for re-election next year. This sets the stage, Aaron, for an election campaign. She probably, I assume, would have been a favorite running for re-election, given she's won handily in the past.
Yep.
Looking at recent Supreme Court elections in Wisconsin, what do you make of either sides? I'm putting sides in quotes, chances of having the seat.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's going to be a competitive race. From what I've seen, there are already a couple people who said they're thinking about jumping in or have jumped in. So I think expect it to be competitive. In the last race that we just saw, you know, not too long ago, there was a lot of campaign spending. There were ads. It got kind of nasty. You know, partisanship was on full display. So it wouldn't surprise me if those same kinds of things occurred in the election to replace her.
The conservative majority has been 5-2. It would be 4-3 with the newly elected justice, and then it'll be up in the air. It won't be a liberal, putting that in quotes again, majority, no matter what happens.
Yep.
Next year. What do you think that there's a trend among voters going one way or the other in the last, looking at the most recent election, is that going to hold into the future?
You know, I think We have a lot of time before the election happens, so it depends on what the context is at that time. You know, we don't know what kind of forces will be at play or what kind of issues will be brought up. So, you know, I think it'll be competitive. We'll have to wait and see sort of as the candidates or as the nominees come forward, you know, what they look like. But bet it's going to be a competitive race.
And Aaron, leave us with a little civics 101. What is at stake in the state Supreme Court? What range of issues ends up in front of them?
Yeah, I mean, the Supreme Court takes up all kinds of issues, some that don't get very much attention at all, and some that are, you know, really ideological issues like voter ID and things that Governor Walker has done. So, you know, people care a lot about the Supreme Court, and they should, because, you know, what they say matters, and they're going to be ruling on issues that affect people's lives. So I think that's why people care so much about who's running and who wins in these races.
Aaron, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Aaron Weinschenk is an associate professor of political science at UW-Green Bay. He joined us to take a look at the legacy of Wisconsin Supreme Court Justice Shirley Abramson. She was the first woman to be appointed to the bench and then was reelected, ultimately serving as a justice now for more than 40 years. Abramson announced that she will not seek reelection when her term ends in July of next year. After last year's surprisingly good season, expectations were pretty high for the Milwaukee Brewers in 2018. But not many people thought they'd have the best record in the National League at this point. After yesterday's win against the St. Louis Cardinals, the Brewers are 36-21. That's the best start in franchise history. They've taken six straight series. They won 19 games in May. That's a club record. They haven't even lost back-to-back games in more than a month. With numbers like that, a lot of things must be going right, but can they keep it up? Tom Hodricourt is the Brewers beat reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Tom, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, Rob, how are you?
Well, good. Now, Tom, I talked to you a couple weeks back when you're out in Arizona for spring training. Did you see a record start in the cards for the Brewers at that point?
Well, I think, as you just noted, we thought the Brewers would be good, but I don't think anyone can ever project that they're going to have the best start through X number of games in franchise history. And, you know, back in April when they were kind of spinning their wheels a little bit, and especially having a tough time with the Chicago Cubs, you know, it was difficult to say, oh, they're going to get to May and all of a sudden flip the switch and be so good. You know, they won 19 games in May, the most in club history. And they just they have a lot of positive numerical markers, you know, the last several weeks. They're 15-5 in their last 20 games. You know, they won six straight series. I can't tell you the last time something like that happened. As I just mentioned, 19 victories in May. And then, as you mentioned at the start of the segment, best record in the National League. So, they just have all of these very positive numerical markers that, you know, rightfully have their fans excited.
Last year at this time, we looked back, the Brewers were just a few games over 500. Not bad, not remarkable. Is there one thing you can point to that changed between now and then, or even maybe between April and May this year, and say, aha, that's the thing that's nudging them to this new level?
Well, they got their offense going. They had really had trouble scoring runs consistently in the month of April. You know, they were shut out five times by the Cubs in April. That was kind of a nutty thing going on, that they just couldn't score on the Cubs pitching. It wasn't like no one else was scoring on the Cubs pitching. And so they got the offense going. Their bullpen has just been out of sight, you know, just one, arguably the best bullpen statistically in the major leagues. And so they've always been good protecting leads, but they were just having trouble scoring runs and getting leads for a while. But then that changed. Lots of different guys got hot. Travis Shaw got hot. Jesus Aguilar, a very good story on the team, a guy who was supposed to be a backup player but then got his chance to play every day when Eric Thames was injured, has been a tremendous run producer. And then, you know, the two guys they picked up in the offseason that everybody was so excited about, Kane and Yelich, have just been as advertised. They've been on base a lot, scored a lot of runs. Yelich hit a monster home run yesterday off the scoreboard that tied the game after St. Louis had gone ahead with two runs in the seventh, the top of the seventh. So it's just they have a lot of good things going for them now. Their starting pitching has been decent, not great. If that picks up the pace, you know, they'll be even a better team.
I want to pick apart a few of the things you just mentioned there, Tom, and one is that relief pitching, the bullpen you mentioned. And I was looking at stats. I hadn't realized this. Over time, over the last few years, the amount of time, the number of innings that the starting pitcher is spending on the field in Major League Baseball has been going down and down, slowly but surely, and that makes that relief pitching more important, right?
Yeah, this baseball's become a bullpen game. The Brewers are averaging less than 5 1/3 innings per start. And if that sounds really low, well, the major league average is just over 5 1/3 innings. So they're just a tick behind the average. The analytics have become a huge driver in how games are played now. And, you know, they show that the third time through the batting order, starters, unless you're one of the elite starters, like a Max Scherzer or a Chris Sale or Justin Verlander, in other words, the general population starters are scuffling the third time through. So get them out of there, get some fresh arms in there. Now, you got to have the bullpen to do it. I know some teams are scuffling out of their bullpens. Cleveland's bullpen is probably the reason they haven't done any better than they have. But the Brewers' bullpen, here's a number that just tells you all you need to know about the Brewers' bullpen. When they have gone into the seventh inning with a lead this season, they're 26-0.
That's pretty amazing. I mean, you expect them, you know, if you're ahead in the seventh inning, you have the inside track there toward winning. But they haven't given up that lead once this entire season so far.
Well, let's correct that. They have given up the lead. They just haven't lost the game.
Gotcha.
They haven't lost the game. So yesterday is a perfect example. They took a lead into the seventh, surrendered it, but then got it right back. But it's still a direct indication of how good their bullpen's been. You would think you would lose one game for sure by now. We're over, you know, we're a third of the way into the season now when leading after six. And their bullpen, you know, Josh Hader is like one of the greatest stories in baseball. You know, he's this lanky kid with his real long hair, goes out there and slings the ball in an unusual left-handed style. He's striking out two hitters for every inning he pitches, which is an outrageous ratio. And he's become like a rock star in their bullpen, and he's getting all kinds of national love now. And we're sort of seeing a star is born in this kid. You know, he's only a second year in the major leagues.
Is this something that the Brewers set out to do? Hey, we realize relief pitching is the key to the game as it's changing now, and we're gonna just put everything out there to get good relief pitchers? Or did they do the things that teams always do and they stumbled into a really good bullpen?
Yes and yes. every team wants to build a good bullpen because, as I just said, the game has become a bullpen game. But you just really never know when you put these guys together in spring training Is it going to be as good as we think? Is it going to be less than we think? Is it going to be way better? Is it going to be way worse? Bullpens kind of evolve over time, Rob, and but this one, just right out of the chute, was good. But, you know, some of them are back from last year. Some of them are brand new to the team. Some of them have been around for years in the major leagues, like Matt Albers and Boone Logan. Some of them have only been in the major leagues a couple of years, like Jacob Barnes and Josh Hader. And so, you know, it's like Craig Counsell, the manager, often, you know, uses the soup analogy. You put all these ingredients into the pot and stir them all up and hope that it was a good recipe and it's a good soup. But sometimes it's not, and you have to toss it out and start over again.
Talking to Tom Hodricourt, Brewers beat reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, a record start, a record pace so far this season for the Brewers, number one in the National League right now. Tom, I want to talk a little more about a story you mentioned. Jesus Aguilar, you said one of the big stories in the entire major leagues this year. You wrote a piece on him. He was, you know, knocking around the minor leagues for a long time, a backup in major leagues, and just waiting in the wings for that chance.
Yeah, he never knew if he would get it or not, Rob. He was buried in Cleveland's system behind a bunch of good first basemen, and he played for three years at the AAA level and led his league in home run, I think two of the 3 years, if not all three, and he just wanted to get a chance there. And then one day, shortly before the start of spring training last year, Cleveland put him on waivers because they needed to sign somebody else and they just weren't using him. The Brewers snapped him up right away. He shows up in Maryvale last spring. He's a big hulking guy, you know, like 6'4", 290, big, you know, big slugger.
You could start him at fullback maybe in the NFL.
Yeah, exactly. Or nose guard even, you know. So he hits all these home runs in Maryvale last year, opens everybody's eyes, makes the Brewers keep him. Then he has a very nice year as the backup first baseman to Eric Thames last year. Makes the team again this year. Eric Thames gets hurt. All of a sudden he's playing every day, and he's just driving in 2, 3, 4 runs every day. They put him in the number 3 hole, which had been the exclusive property of Ryan Braun for years, and you know they dropped Braun down in the lineup recently, and that's how good he's been. Their first 4 hitters, Rob, Lorenzo Cain, Christian Yelich, Jesus Aguilar, and Travis Shaw, have just been dynamite. You know, they don't want to break them up. They not only set the table, they serve the dinner, they clean off the table, they bring out the coffee and cheese platter. You know, they just take it. These guys are doing way more than setting the table.
And Ryan Braun, now this could have been an issue, like, hey, Ryan Braun, we want to take away your number 3 spot, move you back a couple steps in the lineup. Not everybody's going to, you know, welcome that with open arms. It went okay?
It did. And then he actually went into Craig Counsell's office and said, I know you're probably struggling with this decision. Ryan had been on the disabled list, so he wasn't playing. And during that time, they put Aguilar in the 3 hole, and he went crazy. And so Braun, you know, when he got past the back issue that had put him on the DL, you know, met with counsel and said, you know, I agree you'd be nuts to break up this first 4. You know, why don't you drop me down? So they've got him batting 5th. That's a really good place for him because then he protects Shaw, you know, their cleanup hitter, from people pitching around him. And so his first game in the 5 spot, he got 3 hits. So it didn't seem to bother him at all. But, sometimes you have to change the plan, you know, and you have to be flexible in baseball. It's a long season. It's a lot of ups and downs lately, mostly ups, but we'll see if they can continue. Memorial Day is a fairly significant marker. People kind of look and see who's in first place on Memorial Day, especially if they have any kind of lead. And a lot of times that projects or forecasts playoff teams, not always, but, you know, we still got more markers to come, but so far so good.
Now, how do they stack up against their division? They're in first place, but they've got a losing record, I understand, in their division, the National League Central. Does that worry you a little bit in the long haul?
Well, it's all Cubs-driven. They're 1-7 against the Cubs, and that's why they're doing fine against everybody else, doing fine, great against Cincinnati, fine against Pittsburgh. They've done good against St. Louis. They've won the last 2 seasons. It's all Cubs-driven. They've played them 8 times and lost to them 7 times. One of those series was in Wrigley Field in April, and it was more suited for the Iditarod than it was for baseball. And the Cubs weren't scoring many runs either, but they would win like 1-0, 2-0. You know, the Brewers got shut out 3 of the 4 games. Wind was howling in about 30 miles an hour. It just was, the guys couldn't feel their fingers. So let's see what happens when they play them again, because they're playing better. The weather's better. They have many more games against the Cubs. But, you know, the Cubs, they've been the top dog in the division now for a few years. So the division's going to go through Chicago, and the Brewers know that, and they seem prepared to put up that fight.
Tom, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thanks, Rob. Appreciate it.
That's Tom Hotchkiss. He's the Brewers beat reporter for the Milwaukee Journal-Sentinel. We talked with him about the team's surprising great start to the season. If the board games on rotation in your house are mostly classics, say those old Milton Bradley games, the Candyland, originally made in 1949, or the Game of Life, back in 1860, released as the Checkered Game of Life, there might be room for some new additions. And summer, I think, is a great time to find some new games to play. If you're an experienced board gamer, you can share some of your favorites with us, or if you need a recommendation for an event, an age group, a family size, you name it, you can call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What's your game? Margaret Rasmussen is a manager at I'm Bored Games and Family Fun in Middleton. Margaret, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, you're welcome.
Now, when did you first get into board games?
I played as a kid like everyone. When I met my now husband back in college in the early 90s, we played. When we had kids, we didn't play very much. But really, in 2004, when Ticket to Ride came out, that's kind of when we came back and played. And now I'm playing several times a week.
Let's talk about Ticket to Ride as an example of what people call gateway games. You know, there's the games we grew up with, the Clues and Monopolies and Life and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And some people do know, some people don't know, there's this whole other world of games out there. Ticket to Ride is one. Talk a little bit about
it. Is the big thing about the games that are out now, you can call them hobby games, you can call them strategy games. The big thing about them is it's not you roll dice and then you move. There's a lot more different strategies that you're going to be doing. Sometimes you're scoring points throughout the game so you can see, you know, how well you're doing. Other ones, you know, you're working as a team to beat the game. There's cooperative games, so it's just one of those things where you can play the game, the same game, over and over again, but it might be different every time that you're playing it.
Before we get more into particular games, this is one of those hobbies that it seems like the internet and phones and all the games, the digital games, computer games, console games, might have killed. It's really been the opposite, right?
It is. And again, a lot of it is, you know, Facebook used to be fun, email used to be fun, and now it's yet another chore you have to do. And there's something to be said for sitting down across the table from someone and actually interacting with a human being. And that's what board games do.
And my blessing, or maybe curse, so I'm a big board game mm-hmm. nerd, I think, a big fan of games. And one thing the internet did was come up with sites like Board Game Geek or others where you could find out about all the games you never heard of and, you know, buy them online or then find stores as they started carrying them or get those games republished. And all of a sudden, this whole world of games to spend money on opened up.
It is. And it's an industry that's exploded. Last year alone, there were over 3,000 games that came out. So every day there's, you know, 10 new titles that are coming out and you're never going to be able to find them all. So that is what's nice that, you know, there's these internet websites out there like Board Game Geek, where it's really just this gathering of people that have similar interests as you. But, you know, there's reviewers, there's videos, so you can actually find a lot of information. There's a lot of brick and mortar stores where you can go in and you can talk to another person to get recommendations.
Or play the game there.
Or play the game there, like at our store. But the big thing is it's not scary. And like Ticket to Ride or the gateways, the fun thing about those is, you know, you can learn how to play them within 5 minutes. And, you know, somebody I'm teaching has a very good shot at beating me, even though I've been playing the game for 10 years. There's just, they're very welcoming to new people and to people who've played them forever and want to keep playing them.
We're talking about board games with Margaret Rasmussen from I'm Bored Games and Family Fun in Middleton. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Vicki is with us in Oregon. Vicki, hi.
Hello. Settlers of Catan is a huge hit in our house. My kids were learning to play it even before they were really old enough to actually understand it. And, you know, it's just one of those games that when we get together with friends is always at the top of the pile for us to play.
Thank you so much for calling, Margaret. Settlers of Catan, now just called Catan, right?
In the newer editions? Yep, the newest edition, they dropped the name and is now just called Catan. That one has been around for, it's got to be 15, 20 years now. New people are still being brought into the hobby with that one. That's a great example of a game where, you know, you can be playing it again and again, and there's always something different. There's, of course, expansions that'll make it even more, but just the base game, different people you play it with, and it's a great one to introduce new friends that maybe haven't played these games before.
Right. I mean, there are some more hardcore games out there. They're longer. They're more complicated to learn. Catan is one that, even with my, I guess, non-gamer friends, I might think of them, they're happy to play that.
They're happy to play that. It's going to be, you know, about an hour and a half. You know that before you start playing, so people can be aware of it. You know, some of the things, like a couple years ago, there was an article about how the Green Bay Packers offensive line, you know, got together and played Settlers of Catan, and they were apparently very competitive. So you can be casual with it, or you can be super competitive like those guys were.
Let's go to another caller. Thanks for that call. We've got Helen with us in Madison. Helen, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about, Helen?
I'm playing Avalon.
A game called Avalon?
Yeah.
And is that one to a fun one to play with a big group?
Yeah.
All right, Helen, thanks for telling us about that. Avalon.
Avalon is actually going to be, it's like the Resistance, which is one of those hidden team games. Half the people playing are on one team, the other half are on another, and you don't know who's on your team. Avalon is a very similar game, but set in King Arthur. So it's got a few different rules, but again, it's all about hidden team. Who's your friend and who's your enemy? You don't know. That's what you're figuring out as you go through.
So I haven't played this one. Is it half of us are on Team King Arthur and half of us are on Team Mordred or something like that?
Yes, but there's also a Merlin in there, which it basically is a little bit more complex than Resistance.
Interesting, Helen. Thanks a lot for sharing that with us. So we'll go next to Chris on the line in La Crosse. Chris, hi.
Hi. I was just going to call about a game called Puerto Rico. I encountered it when I was on a deployment with the Army, and it turned out to be really fun for us.
And that one, I have this one and have played it a lot. You are developing Puerto Rico. You develop resources, ship them back to Europe, that kind of thing?
Yes, and you get some gold, and you manage your island. And I learned something about something called European strategy board games, where it's not so straightforward like a Monopoly. And I think if after this radio program, I might be headed towards the game shop and spark the weekend up.
Chris, thanks a lot for the call. And he mentioned European strategy games. People call them Euro games or German-style games. A lot of this came from Germany and elsewhere in Europe.
It did. So like Settlers of Catan, for example, came out of Germany. This has been the hobby, you know, we've always had like the Axis and Allies and things like that. You know, the war games in Germany, they were a little bit more sensitive. They don't have towards that. They don't have the World War II games because of their history. So they have, you know, farming in the, or you're building a provincial village in France, you know, Carcassonne, or like Puerto Rico, where you're building up Puerto Rico. So they're called Euros or European, or like you said, German style. Nowadays, however, they are pretty much made everywhere. There's some out of the Czech Republic. There's some out of Poland. The U.S. actually has a lot of designers and companies. So it's more of a style of game now versus the actual location of where they come from. But they're going to be a little bit more complex as far as the rules set goes. Usually your first time playing the game, you're just trying to figure out how to play, not necessarily how to win. So they're designed to be played again and again, and there's a lot of different strategies, usually many paths to victory.
Let's talk about that right out of the box concept. I think a lot of these games, people will do themselves a favor if they're the owner of the game. Read the rules, maybe lay it out on the table first. This is how I do most games. I don't open it up for the first time, unless it's like a real, you know, a party type game. I do homework first.
There's different levels of game. So some of them, like the party games, they're designed that, you know, you open it with everyone around you, you sit down, usually the rule book is about a page long, and you can, you know, go ahead and start having fun right away. Other ones, like Puerto Rico or some other ones, you are going to want to, you know, open the box, spend a little time with the rule book. My husband, for example, he's the one that reads all the rule books in our house. And, you know, we put the pieces out and we actually see, okay, this is what they're talking about. How does it move before we actually sit down and play the game?
I actually have friends who buy games, give them to me to read the rules and learn, and then teach them to play the game they've bought. So that's definitely my role in life.
Exactly. Yeah. And some people, that actually is their favorite part of the hobby, the finding the new games and teaching them. I've actually had customers that will open the games, look at them, and play them around, but never actually play with another person because they need to find people that want to play that heavy of a game or
and
that style
that time,
of a game.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Let's talk about games that you can show up at the party, sight unseen, and open it. I think people have seen Apples to Apples. That's one that doesn't take a lot of advanced work to figure that out. What are some other ones that might fit that bill?
Well, there's a lot of the party games, and I say that saying, you know, that they're designed to go to a party. You don't necessarily have to have a large group, but they can handle a large group. There's a lot of the party games have come kind of from, you can go back and see where they originally originated from. Apples to Apples is one. Everybody's familiar with Pictionary, you know, Trivial Pursuit. So there's different branches of the family. So like Dixit is a great game that kind of does a take on Apples to Apples. It's basically pictures. So you're trying to get your picture associated with someone else. Another one that's absolutely fantastic is Codenames. That one's a word association game. I've played it with 20 plus people. I've also played it with four. So it's got a nice wide breadth. And again, you can teach someone how to play it in about 30 seconds. And it's team-based. So even if somebody doesn't know what they're doing, they can kind of go along for the ride, which is fun.
We're talking to Margaret Rasmussen, manager at I'm Board Games and Family Fun Store in Middleton. We're talking about the best board games to play, maybe to try out this summer. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What was your favorite board or card game growing up? Is there one that you're playing now that you can't wait to teach new people? Do you need a recommendation from our guest for a good game to get, maybe for a weekend getaway coming up? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We're picking up our conversation about board games for kids, families, grown-ups, everyone. Margaret Rasmussen is with us, manager at I'm Board Games and Family Fun in Middleton. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're a big fan of board games, how did you get into it? What is your favorite game? Is there something you remember playing as a kid you'd like to bring back? Do you need a recommendation from our guest? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll go back to our callers now. Stacy is with us in Fort Atkinson. Stacy, hi.
Hi there. I am just wondering if you can give a shout out to any local board game designers or any board games that you know of that have been pretty popular by Wisconsin board game designers.
Stacy, thanks a lot for the call. You mentioned there are a lot of new American-made games, and there are some Wisconsin makers with games on the market.
There are, actually. There's quite a few that are here in town. A couple people that have new games that are coming out or have just come out recently. Keith Mateka has done a game called Role Player.
Got that, yeah.
And he just came out with Monsters and Minions, which is where it's an expansion, so it allows you to do new things with the original game. Kirk Dennison is going to have a new one out called Gearworks. He did it through Kickstarter. So that one will be releasing sometime this summer. I want to say July. I could be wrong on that, so don't hold me to that date. There's also quite a few other designers. Kane Klenko, I know he's working on a few new things, but he's got a wide variety of different games. He did Fuse, which is a fun little 10-minute game. It's real time, so you've got a timer that you're working against. It's cooperative, so you're working as a team to try and beat the game. And then he's even done one where you are actually flicking little things through the air. So it's dexterity. think Tiddlywinks meets Space Invasion. So.
That sounds good. And I've got one called Starving Artists. I can't remember the designer's name, but it was a Wisconsin designer.
Yes, Mike, and I'm blanking on his last name. I'm sorry about that, Mike. Well,
beautiful cards because they're replicas
art.
Of art, but you don't have to be able to do art, which is good for me.
Correct. And the fun thing about that is it's everything from the classics all the way through like comic book
right.
art. And the my favorite is the ones like the posters, like the 50-foot woman. Those actually are worth more money in the game. So, because those guys got paid, unlike the famous artists who didn't get paid.
Stacy, thanks a lot for the call. We'll go next to Daniel in Kewaskum. Daniel, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to mention a really fun cooperative game that I've played with my family and friends. It's called 5-Minute Dungeon. It's sort of a speed golf version of Dungeons & Dragons, but more accessible. You can have up to five players. You get five player cards. And you, there'll be like warrior on, or wizard, and you play against a boss card in the middle. And there's a deck of cards with mini bosses and like lesser enemies, and there'll be symbols in the middle, and then the players will try to match those symbols to defeat the cards. And as you go up in bosses, there's five in total, you add more cards to the deck. But yeah, it's a really fun one.
Daniel, thanks a lot for the call. And there's a lot of that fantasy Dungeons and Dragons theme in board games, right?
There is. That's one of the more popular themes that are out there. Again, Dungeons and Dragons itself is actually having kind of a revival, I think, due to Stranger Things, you know, and it's becoming cool for teenagers again. The other fun thing is, you know, like 5-Minute Dungeon, it's another one of those that's cooperative. That's a huge thing right now, is it's fun to have everybody worked as a team
against the game,
the game, which is great when you have siblings who may or may not need a little help working together. You can do that, and it's also fun for parents because you can try your hardest because you're, you know, trying to beat the game, so you're working as a team.
Thanks for that call. We'll go next to Alan in Two Rivers. Alan, hi.
Hi there. Actually, talking about D&D, that's the one I wanted to throw out there. I'm in three groups right now, three different D&D groups, two every week, and then one I run for my little sister. And I just think it's a great creative game to get into because it's pretty much all based off of the players.
Alan, thanks a lot for that call. And that's, so it's in the role-playing game category. A lot of overlap, I imagine, between the people who are into board games and role-playing games.
There is. And a role-playing game, the thing about that is it's a lot of imagination. So for Dungeons and Dragons, for example, for people who aren't familiar with it, there's one person that's the dungeon master, and their goal is not to necessarily beat the players. Their goal is to try and make it so everybody's having fun. But they're the ones that, you know, has an adventure that everybody's going on, and they kind of keep track of everything. The players are all going to play different characters, and they are going to try to, you know, complete the quest and not, you know, get wounded or killed. The fun thing about it is you can do it with just pieces of paper, or there's all sorts of little plastic monsters that you can have on the table. A fun thing with a lot of people's 3D printing is they're creating all sorts of worlds and stuff. So it's very creative and enjoyable.
Alan, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We're talking about board games with Margaret Rasmussen from I'm Bored Games and Family Fun in Middleton. Still time for you to call in with your game suggestions or ask for a recommendation for you and your group at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Dennis is with us now in Milwaukee. Dennis, hi.
Hi. A group of friends and I have been playing Betrayal at House on the Hill for almost 3 years now and have not been able to find a kind of a next game to move on to. So I was looking for a good recommendation, kind of a game along the same lines that has the same kind of feel to it, same kind of strategy.
Okay, Dennis, thanks. Margaret, can you tell us a little bit about that game and then maybe share a, if you like this, play this?
Sure. Betrayal at the House on the Hill is one of those games where there's actually 50 scenarios in it or haunts. So what's going to happen is you will be playing as a team right up until one of you either goes crazy or turns evil. There's different things that can happen to you.
And so then, your piece does that. You personally don't.
Yes, you personally don't, but your little character does. And then it becomes one against many. The fun thing about that is it's one of those games that, again, is easy to get new people into. Just want to let you know, if you adore that game, there is a legacy version that's going to be coming out this fall. A legacy game is where you actually make permanent changes to the game. I know other legacy games, you're stickering up things or you're writing on the board or cards. There's even some where you're tearing up pieces to be thrown away, which is a little hard to get used to. But
I have a hard time with that.
It's actually quite enjoyable when you do that. If you like the horror theme or the Cthulhu world of Lovecraft, I really recommend Mansions of Madness 2nd Edition. That one is going to have an app. So that's another big thing that's happening now, is the technology is being added. And so you'll download a free app, and it takes care of a lot of the bookkeeping and the setup. So it's just a little easier to get into. And that's another one that's great as you're working as a team.
Hope that helps, Dennis. We'll go next to Greg in Barneveld. Greg, hi.
Hello. I haven't heard anybody mention Stratego. When I was in college, we used to play that for hours and hours, but we had a little rule change on it. I don't know if you're familiar, but bombs never move. We had moving bombs, and then we had to elevate the status of the miner. And it made it a really, really good game.
Greg, thanks a lot for that call. So that's the one. I played that as a kid where you see your pieces, your opponent sees their pieces. You don't see each other. So there's that mystery element
there
of guessing
is.
Which
you
is
can
which.
See that they have a piece. You just don't know what piece is over there. Stratego's another game that's been around for forever, and they keep coming out with new versions with new rules. Some of them are quite complex. There was one for the Waterloo Battle, and then there's the one in the future with Space Marines. So that's a great one.
Thanks a lot for the call. We heard an email from Margo who says, my family and I really enjoy Machi Koro, which I haven't played. We were initially struck by how very kind the rules were when people ran out of money. You can't go into debt. Margo says, do you have any suggestions for games similar to that or Ticket to Ride?
A couple of games that I really enjoy. Dominion is a fun one. That is one like Machi Koro where you are actually going to be adding new cards to your hand. So how you play the game is going to be slightly different from another person how they play the game. Another one that's great is going to be called Takedo. That one is a very pleasant game. You are just going on a journey on the Takedo Road, and whoever has the best journey, you stop at little tea houses or temples, and whoever has the best journey is the one that actually wins. But it's more about the adventure.
And I want to ask in our last minute or so, Margaret, so I'm going to put you on the spot. Suppose you have the right number of people you need, the right amount of time you need, what game would you want to play in that instance?
My personal favorite is called Bonanza. It's a game that's been out for, again, 15, 20 years, and you are bean farming.
Yeah, this is a theme that's going to grab people right off the bat. You are farming and trading, right?
Yes,
beans.
You are trading beans. And it's a fun little quick card game, but at the heart of it, it's actually going to be just a crazy trading game like Pit. Doesn't have that quick speed member, but it's all about, can I make a better deal with you than you can with me?
And do you see, you mentioned 3,000 new games out last year, I think you said. Do you see this as a hobby that people are going to keep getting more and more into?
It is, actually. The most people that we have coming in are people that are new to the hobby, and they're growing with it. There's so many new casual games. Even people, that have been playing the games that take 8 hours or things. It's fun to have the casual games because sometimes you just have a half hour and that's what you want to play and you want to go to bed at a decent hour on a school night.
Margaret, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're welcome.
That was Margaret Rasmussen, manager at I'm Board Games and Family Fun in Middleton. That's I'm B-O-A-R-D, by the way. She joined us to talk about board game recommendations for this summer. There's still time for you to weigh in, by the way. You can tweet us, what are you playing this weekend? Tweet us at Central Time WPR. Or post over at the Ideas Network Facebook page. I'm always looking for recommendations too, so share them online. It's the big game this week in the world of competitive spelling. The Scripps National Spelling Bee Finals started earlier today. 11 million spellers started off in schools around the country about 8 months ago. Narrowed down to 519 leading up to B Week. And today, if I have this right, just 16 spellers kicked off the finals. But how are the rest of us doing when it comes to spelling tricky words? Google Trends released a map showing the most common spelling requests for each state. So that's when people go online and type, how do I spell, whatever the word is. The number one spelling request here in Wisconsin is beautiful. And we share that point of confusion with our neighbors in Illinois and their neighbors in Indiana and some states on both coasts. And, when you look at the word, I think this is what I do okay on. But yeah, E-A-U all clumped together, making the U sound. It doesn't make much sense. So that makes sense that people would be confused. And it's a word that's going to come up pretty often. Say you're writing a love letter. You want beautiful in there. Now, rounding out our neighbors, Iowa has trouble with vacuum. Which is, that's good. How many words have two U's? And then Minnesota and Michigan join Texas and some other states. Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious. So, all right. On one hand, yes, it is hard to spell. On the other hand, how often is that going to come up in your daily life? Not too often. My stumbling blocks are entrepreneur, which I got right on my first try earlier today, and Mediterranean, which I did not. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.